Hi, I'm Josh Knope from Yale University.
Hi, I'm Katherine Kinsler from the University of Chicago.
And today we're going to be talking about some work that you've been doing on a rarely thought of kind of social group. So it seems like people are always talking about the idea that people are divided up, say, by race, by gender, by age, by sexuality. But a lot of your work has been focusing on the way that people are divided up by language.
So you're definitely right that we care a lot about social groups, right? So, we care about who's in our in-group. We care personally. We also, I think, care as, thinking about being good citizens and thinking about creating a society where we would care less about group membership. But so a lot of my work looks at a category that we might not think about automatically as implying group membership. So, which is how we speak. So language, we might think of as something that's about communication that conveys messages between people, across many different kinds of people. But when you say something, you don't just reveal the content of what you're saying. You also say a lot about who you are by, the accent or the language that you use to convey that message.
So it seems like this kind of cue, the cue of language, might in many cases be much, much more powerful than cues about, say, how you look, even like what your skin color is, how you dress.
Yeah, I think it can be. And, I often think about language as, why would it be so powerful? So in some ways, it's a really honest signal of what your native social group is. So, as anybody who's tried to take a foreign language class in college or beyond, or, even in high school, it can be really, really difficult to learn a non-native language. If you move to somewhere where the accent is really different, often you kind of stand out like a sore thumb that people know that you're not from around there, right? And so in that sense, I think that accent can serve as a really reliable marker of where you grew up and who your native, group was. At the same time, I think that we often also take this too far. So, we can generate, if you ask people, stereotypes about different groups of speakers, they'll have, lots to say about people who sound like X, are like Y. And that's, of course, not always true at the individual level. And so that's where I think that this kind of, accent, people often talk about accent attitudes, the idea that you'd have some really strong attitudes about people based on how they speak, without knowing anything about that individual person and, his or her actual characteristics.
It seems actually like this particular way of judging people by their way of speaking is much more powerful than others. Like, if I saw someone, for example, who looked and dressed just like sort of a gang member, but then when he started speaking like a professor.
Yeah.
I would immediately think, forget about the way he dresses, forget about the way he looks. He's really a professor. And then by contrast, if I saw someone who looked just like a professor, but then when he spoke, his actual, accent or dialect was just like that of a gang member, I might think, forget about how he looks. He's really a gang member.
Yeah, I think that's right. Maybe that's why professors get away with, wearing jeans to work and that sort of thing.
Oh, because as soon as we open our mouths and start talking about multigrade and Ovis or whatever, then...
But yeah, I think you're right that, when you see somebody, of course, there's all sorts of evidence from psychology that you're instantly kind of judging them and, interpreting what they look, things like it's really easy to encode somebody's gender, race, and age, and that's something that you could really, kind of automatically do. But at the same time, when somebody opens, her mouth and gives you some evidence about, what, not just what she's talking about, but also, the way that she speaks or the way, the accent or the language that she's using, you just get a lot of information about that person.
Thinking about this issue, there's actually a website called Prof or Hobo, and it shows pictures of people, and each one is either a homeless person or a professor, and you completely can't guess. You look at it, is that a homeless person or a professor? There's no way of knowing. But by contrast, if you had a bunch of clips of dialogue, and you had to guess, which is a professor, which is a homeless, I feel like you could guess much more accurately. So it seems like what's going on in these cases is that we're taking somehow the linguistic cue as opposed to the visual cue as being the true signal of group membership. So a lot of your work on this stuff has actually been not with adults, but with infants.
Yeah, that's right. So when I started as a graduate student, I was really interested in questions about, is this, we know from lots of research from psycholinguistics and sociolinguistics that that adults judge other people based on how they speak. And so our question was, you know, whether this is something that, you know, kind of happens with really complex knowledge of different groups of people. You know, you could live in the world for a while and gain all sorts of access to cultural stereotypes and things about different groups of speakers. But we were interested in whether humans might see language as, you know, providing social meaning about somebody, about someone's identity, or about their group membership really early in life. You know, is this something that's kind of intuitive for humans to do? So this was work when I was a graduate student at Harvard, working with Elizabeth Spelke. We were interested in whether really early in life babies might demonstrate preferences for people who speak in a native accent of their native language. Now, you know, I use the term native here, but babies aren't speaking themselves. So, you know, in this case, we were, you know, working with babies in Cambridge who were in monolingual English-speaking families. And so what we did a couple different studies where we showed that babies would look longer at somebody who'd previously spoken to them in a native accent of their native language. And then we went on and we used a measure that tried to get kind of an infant's earliest social interactions in a really kind of highly controlled way. So what we did was we showed infants, now these were video displays that showed babies two different people, one who spoke in English and one who spoke in French. And they both, you know, talked to the baby, they said kind of friendly things like, you know, hi baby, it's nice to see you today, you know, that sort of thing, and kind of child-directed speech. And then on screen, they would each hold out a stuffed animal for the baby, two of the same stuffed animals. And then we had this little kind of magic trick where we had two real animals, it's not real animals, real stuffed animals, that would seem to kind of pop out of the screen and emerge on a table in front of the infant, and we could see which, you know, toy the infant reached for. So what we found there were that babies in the U.S. tested, you know, tested near Harvard, would reach for the toys that were offered by the English speaker. And then we tested a group of babies in France who were in monolingual French-speaking families, and they reached for the toy offered by the French speaker. So, you know, these toys were identical, and there was nothing really linguistic about the interaction per se, you know, it's kind of the silent offering event. And these are temperamental babies who, if you've met a temperamental baby, they're really, you know, not talking at that point. But I think that this speaks to how, you know, somebody who speaks in a familiar language can be, you know, perhaps it's something like they're seen as safer, they're more familiar, but babies kind of want to interact with those people over somebody who speaks in a foreign language.
But it's, so it seems like if you mention someone who disagrees with your view, they could say something like, it's not that you see the person who speaks the same language as being an in-group member, and so for that reason someone you want to associate with, but rather, if you're an infant, one of the key tasks that you face is just to learn your native language.
Yeah.
So just in this really straight up, practical way, you want to, as much as possible, associate with people who speak the, your native language and not with other people.
Yeah.
Not because of anything about group membership or anything.
Uh-huh.
So
yeah.
Are there any data that speak to that kind of way?
Yeah. So, you know, that was definitely something we thought about in the sense that, you know, babies are really in the business of learning their native language. Like, that's a major thing that's happening mm-hmm. early in life, right? And they're so much better at it than adults are, which, again, is why I think language is such a good signal of where you grew up and mm-hmm. who you were listening to then, because, you know, you're so good at learning languages when you're young. So, you know, in part, that was one of the reasons that motivated us to start to work with older children, too. So, say, children who are in kindergarten, you know, around 5 years of age. And we've also done some studies with various ages in the middle, like, you know, 2-year-olds and 4-year-olds and whatnot. But we're interested in whether these, you know, kind of language-based social preferences happen only at this age when children are really busy learning their native language or native languages in the case of a child, you know, in a bilingual or multilingual setting. Or whether at the case, you know, a 5-year-old is really a fully proficient speaker of, you know, English or whatever other language a 5-year-old would speak. And we are interested in whether these kinds of preferences continue to exist then. Mm-hmm. And we found, you know, so for instance, we have some studies where we just ask 5-year-old kids, we show them images of different people, children or adults, and then they're paired with voice clips that vary in language and in accent. And children tend to say that they like people who speak in a native accent compared to somebody who speaks in a foreign accent. And this is, you know, the case even when they understand the foreign accents. So, you know, it's not just that, that kids, you know, think a foreign accent as a foreign language. They can understand the content of it, but they still like a native speaker. And in fact, we could even push that further, mm-hmm. such that the native and the foreign accented speaker can both speak in kind of nonsense speech. Like so something that actually doesn't make any sense at all. Mm-hmm. And in that case, they still like the native accented nonsense speaker over the foreign accented nonsense speaker.
Nice. You know what's funny about this study that you're just talking about is, I'm not sure if this is true, but I sort of have the intuition that you wouldn't get that for adults. Like my intuition is that adults have these specific prejudices against specific people who have certain accents. So some adults have prejudice against people who speak with a Southern accent or who speak African American vernacular English. But if you just think about just an accent as being foreign, say it was a French accent or it was an accent that you just couldn't even tell where it was from. You know, someone who spoke with a Danish accent, but weren't even familiar with that. That people wouldn't really have the same kind of just blanket prejudice against anyone who speaks with a foreign accent.
I think that's absolutely the right way to think about it. That, you know, I often think about kind of these early preferences for native as potentially being very different for later kind of, I think you're talking about something more like accent attitudes, where you have an attitude or a stereotype about a particular group of speakers. And so, you know, I think that these are really different and that, you know, preferences probably just like isn't the right way to think about these kinds of phenomena with adults, because these preferences can be so multifaceted. You know, you could think that somebody from a particular accent group is positive on one dimension and negative on another. You know, you could think that they're really competent but really not very warm, or, you know, maybe smart but, you know, not nice, or, you know, whatever.
Yeah, like if someone speaks like the Queen of England or something, I feel like that person is maybe
Americans do often have some really positive stereotypes about British English as being, you know, smart or sophisticated or that sort of thing.
You know, like some of my friends who speak British English have children who speak, you know, British English. Mm-hmm. And there's this weird thing that, I mean, they're children, but they still sound so much more sophisticated than me.
That's horrible.
Then I feel like they should be giving me lessons or something.
Uh-huh.
Wait, so I mean, obviously it seems like you're getting this effect, even with really young children, of preference for same accent, same language.
Yeah.
But do you see, is that just part of just a much larger thing where they're going to show that for all sorts of other signs of in-group membership?
Yeah.
Or is it that there's something really special about language in particular?
Yeah, so, I mean, I think there's something really special about language, though I'm sure there's people out there who would disagree, but, you know, my work that's really spoken to this has tried to compare kids' reasoning about accent with their reasoning about race.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, there's a lot of literature showing, you know, that young children like people, like they like people based on their race without knowing anything else about them. So
mm-hmm.
often this is, as you know, an own race or a familiar race preference, although I think it's actually for a young child, it's probably not about own per se. It's probably, you know, you could imagine a child, you know, who was adopted to a family that looks really different from that child. I think that it would probably be about, you know, the people who are familiar
mm-hmm.
to the child. And so, you know, there's a lot of literature suggesting that kids like, you know, a familiar race, or sometimes at some ages, you know, a majority race if they're a member of a minority group. But regardless, early in life, they're demonstrating preferences based on race. So, you know, one question we had is that, are these language preferences reflecting really, you know, we could call this a domain general tendency to prefer anything that's familiar,
mm-hmm.
which could make a lot of sense, right? That if you're an infant and, you know, we may have evolved to care about familiarity as this marker of safety, right? Things you've encountered before that, you know, haven't eaten you tend to probably be, you know, good things to approach again, right? So what we did is we were interested in contrasting accent with race, so a familiar accent with a familiar race. And what we find for both infants and for older children is that accent tends to matter more. So we did our same kind of toy giving, you know, demonstration to babies. Now these were white babies, and they were shown individuals who are either of European or African descent who offered toys to the babies. And at 10 months of age, we really actually don't find any race-based preferences. So I think that's kind of a note of optimism, that it's at least much harder to find in a baby. Although there is a lot of research on early face perception that's, you know, happening, or, you know, within the first year of life, babies, you know, start to basically become relatively better at face processing for faces that are more familiar to them as opposed to faces that are less familiar. But in terms of these real, like, social interactive preferences, it seems to be harder to capture, you know, race-based preference early on. And then we went on and we tested five-year-olds again. So, you know, these five-year-old kids, we say that they like people who speak in a native accent. We then look at both accent and race. So, you know, we find that when you test either accent or race by itself, mm-hmm. you see, you know, really robust preferences for one or the other. So, you know, a white child in a monolingual English-speaking family who's either shown, you know, a Native American-accented English compared to, say, a French-accented English, they say that they like the American-accented English. Mm-hmm. And then you could show them, you know, white and black faces, and they say that they like the white faces. Mm-hmm. But then when you pit those two variables against one another, mm-hmm. so now this child sees somebody who's white who speaks in a foreign accent versus somebody who's black who speaks in a Native accent, at that point kids continue to go based on accent. So it's almost like, you know, these early race-based preferences could be just, you know, eclipsed by hearing accent, by hearing, you know, how somebody speaks. And then you say, you know, all of a sudden that really changes, I think, your perception of them.
So it seems like kids are thinking in some way, it's really how you speak rather than how you look that reveals It's sort of how you speak rather than how you look that reveals your essence.
Yeah, I think that that's right. That there's, and I mean, so, you know, I think about this notion of essence, that there could be, you know, something about you that's like this really key defining variable, you know, something that's really important in defining who you are, and what, you know, you'll be over time. If you're like A now, you'll be like mm-hmm. A later on. You know, if you have this essence and somebody else shares the same essence, maybe you'll, you know, like similar things or engage in similar social relationships, you know, something like this. And so, you know, in one series of studies with my graduate student Jocelyn Dotel here at the University of Chicago, we sought to test whether children think about language or race as being this kind of really important part of you that might be really stable over time or across an individual's lifespan. And we found some kind of surprising results here. So what we did was we showed children, you know, these were children, we started with children in Chicago. They were predominantly white in our first sample, and they were around 5 years of age. And what we did was we showed them, you know, an image of a child who was either white or black and spoke in English or French. Okay, so it's a 2x2. So we had, you know, all variations of, all four variations of those variables. Okay. And then kids saw two adults. And one of those adults matched the child's race, but not the child's language. And the other one matched the child's language, but not the child's race. So to give you an example, you could have, you know, a white child who's speaking in English, and then a white adult who's speaking in French, and a black adult who's speaking in English. And the question is, which adult will this child grow up to be?
Yeah.
So it's kind of this question, and, you know, it's kind of this question about, you know, what's really stable across the lifespan. And so, you know, adults have the clear intuition when you show them this kind of paradigm that, you know, race is going to be more stable across the lifespan than language. You know, somebody could speak two languages, right? So maybe this is the same bilingual individual over time, or maybe, you know, somebody moved and is now speaking a new language or learned a new language for whatever reason, right? But, you know, people generally tend to look, you know, relatively similar in terms of skin color across their lifespan. Okay, so that's true of adults, and then we tested a group of fourth graders, 9 and 10 year olds, just as kind of a control for this measure, and they say that, you know, that, yeah, race is more, they pick the race match, and they say that, you know, and they say things like, these older kids say things like, yeah, well, maybe, you know, she speaks two languages, or maybe, you know, she learned a new language, you know, something like this. They often act like it's kind of a weird question that we're asking them, like, what's wrong with these experimenters that they don't know this answer? But then we test a group of kindergartners. So, you know, these were predominantly white white kindergartners in Chicago, and they chose the language match.
Awesome.
So it was pretty nuts. I mean, you know, even though I think language is so important, I was kind of predicting that maybe language and race would be equal, you know, but it was a really clear finding. And we replicated it with a second group of kids. And, you know, it seems that they think that language is this, like, stable kind of, you know, essence-y perhaps part of a person that's going to exist across the lifespan, you know, even if that means you have to completely change physical appearance.
So do you think maybe even adults have that kind of sense at a more intuitive level?
Yeah.
I know full well that you can change your language, but you can't change your race. But I feel like that's just some kind of, like, abstract knowledge I have. Yeah. But if I actually was in the experiment, if the experiment was going quickly enough, or if I was distracted by other things, I somehow feel like I would more see language as this just immutable, fundamental truth about people than see their race in that way.
Yeah, I mean, I would love to test that because I share that intuition that, you know, this kind of knowledge, like, you know, I think we do learn a lot about race in early childhood. So, I mean, you know, changing on this task could be that kids think that race is more stable, right? Or it could be that they learn something about language. You know, just anecdotally, I've had the experience, like, I spent a lot of time in France as a graduate student when I was, you know, running these studies with these babies in France. And, you know, things like sitting at a cafe in France and hearing somebody, you know, speaking French, sounding, you know, completely Parisian at the table next to you. And then if all of a sudden that person switches into an American accent of English, it's really jarring. It's like, whoa, I didn't categorize that there was an American next to you. So I feel like that might very well exist in adults too, that when you think about, you know, somebody speaking in one way and then all of a sudden they switch languages, it's just this, you know, it can be really jarring. You know, I think that people use this a lot in like in TV and movies. I don't know if you watched 24, but in the last episode of the first season of 24, when, you know, Nina is speaking, you know, like you think that she's, you know, she's speaking English and then all of a sudden I think it's Russian where she switches and it's like, whoa, she's a bad guy, right? And so I just think that this idea that you categorize someone as, you know, in one way, and then all of a sudden they speak in a different language, it can be really jarring if you don't think that they're bilingual going in.
You know, maybe an example of that would be if you imagine someone changing language versus changing eye color.
Ah.
So we recognize that people change languages. Sometimes it's obviously true that a given person could be speaking one language in the morning and speaking another language in the afternoon.
Mm-hmm.
And it's obviously not true that someone has one eye color in the morning and then another eye color.
Right, right.
But it would be so much less jarring if that happened.
Yeah.
If there was a movie where someone changed eye color, it would be like, I don't know, that things happen. Uh-huh. Wait, so it seems like maybe an explanation of this phenomenon that you're talking about just has to do with our sort of evolutionary origins, that we didn't evolve in a context in which there were people around who had very different races. But we did evolve in a situation in which people around had very different languages. So it seems like it would make sense for us to evolve to think of language rather than race as the main cue to group membership.
Yeah, I mean, evolutionary psychologists have definitely, like Rob Kurzban and colleagues, have talked about how, you know, we care a lot about race, but it's not because, you know, human evolution, you know, made it such that this had to be the case or, you know, something like this, right? That, you know, attention to race may not have been positively selected for throughout throughout human history, just given that, you know, prior to the onset of long distance migration, people probably never really came into contact with people who looked very different, you know? So it makes sense that we may have evolved to attend to group membership more generally or to care about, you know, patterns of cooperation and conflict and that sort of thing to kind of figure out like who's with who. But that race may be kind of plugged into this more ancient system today. And I think with that comes kind of this note of optimism that, you know, my guess is that if children were raised in a society where, you know, we cared a lot about hair color, where like light hair versus dark hair, you know, was the thing that we cared about, and neighborhoods tended to, you know, segregate based on hair color, and people tended, you know, often to, you know, develop relationships, friendships, or romantic relationships with people of the same hair color and that sort of thing. My guess is kids would care a lot about that, and it wouldn't have to be skin color.
But But then in terms of the optimism,
yeah,
I don't know. See, if what you're saying is that it's just completely arbitrary that we happen to make this in-group, out-group distinction based on race, and we could really easily switch to another thing in a way that we couldn't easily switch to not caring yeah. about language, then that might be true, but should it make us feel optimistic? So it seems like what you're saying is that...
No, it wouldn't be great if we cared a lot about hair color. You know, at the same time, I think that it is optimistic because I think some people feel like race-based, you know, problems in our society and in other society or something, like it's just there's nothing you can do about it, right? It mm-hmm. feels sometimes like it's just so overwhelming and people care so much that, you know, efforts to reduce prejudice might just, you know, not even be worth it. We could sort of, you know, throw in the towel and just kind of not even think about it. But I think that the optimistic note is that there actually probably could be something to do about it, and where, you know, humans aren't set up in this way that I think we would have to care about race. And sure, you know, I'm not proposing that we, you know, try to make everybody care about, you know, hair color instead, but I do think it suggests that progress on any one variable that's, you know, causing a particular problem, I think that there could be something that could be done.
Right. It seems like, though, it definitely does seem like there's something different about race and language, such that yeah. mm-hmm. kids are just always going to care about language, but we only care about race because of certain facts about how in-group membership is defined in our society.
Yeah. But
so the way that we can get rid of it is just by defining in-group membership in some other ways that we're prejudiced against some other group, then that's not really such
a wonderful... Yeah, that probably wouldn't... I agree. I share the intuition that that doesn't mm-hmm. seem exactly mm-hmm. right. Although, you know, I don't know. I think that there's also ways that, you know, developing... I could imagine that developing, you know, cross-race friendships early on and that sort of thing could mm-hmm. be something that could be really positive.
Mm-hmm.
You know, the other thing I was going to note is I think that early social environments also matter a lot for how kids think about both language and about race. So, you know, there's one whole way to think about, you know, we've been talking about monolingual kids, which is like actually the exception in the world. Mm-hmm. So, you know, these sort of monolingual English-speaking American kids are really the exception, that most children on the planet hear multiple languages. Mm-hmm. So, you know, that's one question about how linguistic diversity could really contribute to, say, like more openness or, you know, something like this along these lines. But the other thing I wanted to note is that early social experiences seem to matter a lot for how kids think about language and about race. So in the study that we were just talking about, the grow-up study, right, where the five-year-old white children are saying that somebody is more likely to grow up to keep a language as opposed to have the same race, we actually test a group of African-American kids living in Chicago who are also 5 years of age, and they're in the same neighborhoods and same mm-hmm. schools as the white kids. And those kids, the African-American kids, look much more like the older white kids.
Uh-huh.
So, you know, they categorize people based on race. They think that race is going to be more constant across the lifespan than language. So, mm-hmm. you know, and I don't really know why that is, but I'm, you know, really interested in trying to figure that out. But I think it must, you know, it clearly has something to do with these kids' early social experiences and social environments that are different. You know, whether it's differences in discourse that they've heard, you know, that, there's some evidence that white parents espouse sort of this colorblind ideology about parenting, as if, you know, we just don't talk about race, that kind of thing. Versus I think that African-American parents are going to be more likely to discuss race with their children, you know, in part to hopefully protect against experiences, potential experiences of discrimination. Then also I think there's issues about, you know, being a minority or a majority member in terms of, you know, the number of people you encounter and that sort of thing. But, you know, regardless of the causes, it seems that these, you know, or the particular mechanism, it seems that these early social environments are really informative, and that the same, you know, a child in the same neighborhood could, at the same age, could have different beliefs about social categorization and about, you know, how much each category kind of matters.
Wait, so when you're talking about early social environments, a lot of the things you've been emphasizing so far have to do with the idea that you figure out, you know, which group you're in, and then you prefer that group.
But yeah.
Is it always the case that kids or even adults prefer people who speak in the way that's their way of speaking? Or do they sometimes prefer the other one?
Yeah. So not always. So I think, you know, in this kind of study, this kind of like you know, this grow up study. In some ways, it's not about the child's own group, because it's more about sort of making these, you know, you're a little bit removed, right? It's not about who you like. It's also about, you know, making judgments or inferences about other people. Mm-hmm. That said, yes, we've been talking a lot about kids liking a native accent, which I think is very true early in development. Mm-hmm. But then also as children start to get a little bit older, I think that, again, this idea about preferences, it's just not the right way to see the problem. And in fact, older children start to not always like their own native accent or dialect. Sometimes they start to like what you might consider to be, you know, the prestige or high status dialect. Mm-hmm. And so you can see kind of this flip with older children, where I think that they're thinking about, you know, language is still conveying information about, you know, social information about social identity. So that doesn't change. But I think that what kids might care about could change in the sense of, you know, preferring somebody who's native or familiar to preferring somebody who's maybe higher in status, and could be considered to be, you know, kind of a good peer in that sense.
So do you think adults have within their minds kind of these two different things about language, that on one hand, there's something where if they see someone of the same group that they're in, they're going to have a positive feeling about that.
Yeah.
But on the other hand, if they have to see someone who has the prestige dialect, they'll have a positive feeling. And maybe they would show up in different...
That's right. I think they probably have both, and it might depend a lot on the kind of question that, you know, you would ask them. You know, I haven't tested this, but I think it would be really interesting if maybe, you know, you might experience slightly more, you know, say imagine more like empathy for somebody who sounds like they're native, but yet you might, you know, want to affiliate with somebody who's higher status, something like that. You could imagine that those kinds of feelings could, you know, both exist at once and be somewhat complex.
Do you know, if I just speculate sort of from my own intuitions, I don't get that I would want to affiliate with just hang out with the person who was of the higher status than me, uh-huh. but more that I would show that person a special kind of respect. Or, so say if someone wanted to be my friend versus to be my boss or something, it would be, to be my boss, you know, it would be better to have whatever makes you seem most prestigious or high status. Uh-huh. But to be my friend, I think it would be better to just be kind of like me. Are you predicting maybe the opposite?
Yeah, no, I think that's right. But I think that, you know, friendship is also kind of multifaceted. Like, you know, if you walk around a professional conference in psychology, right, you're going to see these really famous people and everybody's orienting to them and trying to talk to them, you know, and that sort of thing. So I think that kind of affiliation shows, you know, people want to kind of, you know, be known by your prestige individuals and that sort of thing. But yeah, I mean, as to who are you going to want to have a beer with after the conference is done, that might be a slightly different calculation.
Right, so the kind of thing that I was suggesting actually predicts that those people that you're talking about, that you sort of envy during a conference, that they would actually end up feeling a little bit lonely. I mean, that...
Yeah, that's interesting.
That people would just feel a little bit distant from them and wouldn't want to have a beer with them. They just feel a little bit uncomfortable.
I also think, though, that status, you know, linguistic status could operate, you know, like I think we're talking about some really kind of, you know, big status divides, right? Mm-hmm. But imagine, you know, two people, imagine hearing language that implies that both people are, you know, members of your local community or mm-hmm. your in-group, but one just speaks with, you know, a slightly, you know, an accent that seems a little bit closer to the prestige dialect, you know, something like that, that you could imagine some more fine-grained differences. Mm-hmm. And in that case, I wonder, you know, it seems quite possible that children might prefer somebody who's, you know, a member of the in-group, yet, you know, a higher status member of that in-group.
Oh, right.
Mm-hmm.
But so the idea that we've been talking about so far is that there's just a preference for the in-group and also a preference for the prestige dialect.
Mm-hmm.
But do you ever get the reverse, that there's certain things that, I mean, obviously there are certain things that the high status people are, ways in which you think, well, of a high status people,
yeah.
Are there also certain ways that whatever is the low status dialect will be associated mm-hmm. with certain other good things?
Yeah, so I don't know if this, like, I would be hesitant to call this, you know, status exactly, but I've done some research on kids thinking about Northern versus Southern American English. So, you know, adults have a lot of stereotypes, right, about Southern versus, you know, Northern versus Southern American English. And in fact, you know, linguists have asked people, you know, just sort of getting people's lay intuitions about language in the U.S., and they seem to think that, you know, the South is sort of this, you know, really salient linguistic area to people, even though, of course, there's a tremendous amount of diversity across different accents in the South. It's not like there's just one Southern dialect, you know. At the same time, people, you know, have this idea of this sort of, you know, speech area in the U.S. And so what we did was we looked at, this was research with my graduate student Jasmine DeJesus, where we looked at kids in Illinois and in Southern Tennessee, and we played them, you know, we introduced them to people and voices who were from both both regions. Mm-hmm. And then we asked them, you know, we asked them, who do you like more? Who do you want to be friends with? This kind of social measure. But then we also asked them to try, we tried to assess their knowledge of the kinds of linguistic stereotypes that adults might have. And so we asked them also how nice people were, how smart they were, mm-hmm. and how much they were in charge. Mm-hmm. Okay? And so what we found, so for 5-year-old kids, we found in the North, they liked the Northern accented English compared to the Southern accented English, but they didn't really seem to know why. You know, they didn't really like differentiate across any of the questions. They just generally thought they were a little bit more positive. Versus the kids in the South really treated the two dialects equally, these 5-year-old kids. Now, my guess is that kids in the South are actually somewhat bi-dialectal in the mm-hmm. sense that they're going to hear both dialects probably a lot, particularly through media. Mm-hmm. But then we looked at kids again in 4th grade, so they were 9 and 10 in both places. Then we found something really interesting, which was that children in both places said that they thought that the Northerners sounded smarter and in charge, and the Southerners sounded nicer. Mm-hmm. So, you know, what I thought was really interesting about this was, you know, I expected there'd be some kind of acknowledgement of these sorts of linguistic stereotypes, but I thought perhaps a child in the North would think the Northerners sounded smarter, but didn't necessarily think the Southerners sounded nicer and vice versa in the mm-hmm. South. But, you know, kids were endorsing stereotypes that were both, you know, positive mm-hmm. about their group, but then also more positive about the other group. And they seemed to be gaining access to these stereotypes really, you know, at the same time. I think it's really interesting, you know, where are they getting this information, right?
Yeah, yeah. You're only in 4th grade and you're in the North and you already think that Northerners are less nice.
Yeah, and it's possible that it only takes a few instances of somewhat stereotypic depiction of Southerners, say, you know, in some, you know, some movie or, you know, something like this mm-hmm. where they might have, maybe it doesn't take much to gain access to these kinds of stereotypes.
But so when you say that people see Southerners as nicer, I mean, is that just white people who see Southerners as nicer?
Yeah, so I don't know the answer to this, but I would love to find this out. So I had this research assistant, Valmer Jordan, who was working in my lab one summer, and he's African American and he's from the South Side of Chicago. And, you know, my student Jasmine was presenting these, you know, results in our lab meeting. We were talking about the data. We just collected them. And he mm-hmm. said, you know, are your kids all white that you tested, you know, because he says that, you know, he remembers conversations, as a child and, you know, with, you know, friends and family in his neighborhood saying that, you know, thinking that Southern accented English could be something that's threatening, you know, that wouldn't be nice. And so, you know, I think that that's a really good question about how, you know, stereotypes, accent-based stereotypes seem like they could absolutely differ across different groups of kids. And so I think that's, you know, quite possible that that's the case.
So we should probably wrap up soon, but before we do, I just wanted to hear, what's the next step? You know, what are you working on?
What's the next step? So, so I'm really interested in thinking about these same kinds of questions with children who are in bilingual or multilingual environments. You know, that, as I said, these kinds of monolingual kids are really the exception. Mm-hmm. And I think it's important, you know, we now know a lot about how monolingual children think that language is really important for social group membership. But I think there's really interesting questions about bilingual kids or multilingual kids. So I started to do a little bit of research on this. You know, one research project is in South Africa, where kids were in a really multilingual environment. And there we see actually a lot of the same kinds of phenomena that you might see in the U.S. So both, they seem to care about, like, you know, first we were interested in whether, you know, would they care about language at all? Or if you're exposed to, you know, four different languages, maybe someone, hearing someone who speaks a fifth one, it's just not a big deal, yeah. You know? Versus the difference from one to two seems really noteworthy. But we find that kids in South Africa still seem to prefer people who speak in a native language compared to a foreign language, but then they also start to show, you know, some preferences for South Africans who are speaking in English, even if their native language themselves or their first language isn't English. So I think that could also be about kind of the prestige of English. And then also in the U.S., you know, there are tons of cases, you know, the U.S. is becoming much more multilingual. And so I think there's really interesting questions about how children who speak a language other than English as their first language at home, you know, how do they think about language, as well as other questions just more generally about how being in a bilingual or multilingual environment could influence, you know, children's social reasoning in many different kinds of ways. So that's something I'm really excited about for the future.
Yeah, it definitely seems like it would be striking if it turns out that kids who come from immigrant families, instead of having a prejudice against the other kids that they encounter, have a prejudice against their parents.
Yeah.
I mean,
so I think that sounds horrible. But in some ways, you know, kids seem to learn the language of their peers, not of their parents. I mean, they learn the language of their parents too, right? But if parents speak, you know, if a child in the U.S. has parents who speak English in, you know, an accent that's really different from what they hear in school, and then that child goes to school, that child is going to sound, you know, very American accented English at school. And so I think that in some ways, you know, language, because language has so much social meaning, fitting in with your peers and sounding like them is going to be something that's really important for kids.
Okay, Katie Kinsler, thanks so much.
Oh, thanks so much for having me.